Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A co-presentation of WNYC Studios and Night Vale Presents.
You are listening to the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
We zoom in on a small enclosed space. A dark, womb-like space with walls of metal, where a small figure lies curled, appropriately, in a fetal position, waiting to emerge as if he were the main character of a show about to be born. Metaphorically, that is. He's fully grown. Who is he?
Oh, my arm.
Well, you'll find out soon enough. Where is he? Well, it's pitch black. You can't see. I can tell you this much. He's in a dark hiding place. In one of the most famous buildings in the world. In Paris. And it's a tower. And he's hiding while nearby. A large audience files into a grand ballroom to see the performance of a live radio variety show, which is about to be broadcast.
Broadcasting from the top of the Eiffel Tower, you are listening to the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
But what is he doing? Oh, yes. He's pretending to be on that radio show. He does this. He does all the voices. Right now, he's pretending to be the host, John Cameron.
Thank you so much. It's going to be a wonderful show tonight.
Oh, don't worry. This isn't what the show actually sounds like.
Jacques! Pierre!
Now, he's pretending to be backstage. He's pretending to do the voice of chief stagehand Letitia Saltier. She runs the show.
Allez, allez. We are seeing screws on backstage.
That sounds nothing like her. Oh, good lord.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Now
thank
he's doing host John Cameron again, back on the air.
That was the Orbiting Human Circus Orchestral performing its version of... What are you doing? I'm dusting the microphone.
There he is, doing himself.
Oh, get away from the microphone. I'm sorry. I just thought I should clean up the show a little bit.
Yes, even in his fantasies, he ruins everything. Why? Well, it does make them more realistic. Because that's what he actually does. He ruins everything. He's actually preparing to sneak into that ballroom, sneak on stage, and bumble onto the air, where a person like him certainly does not belong. Not in a medium known for intelligent discourse on important subjects like science, news, and technology. Oh, good lord. For example, there must be something else on.
Welcome to episode 1 of this special edition of the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air, with commentary following each episode and a director's cut of the season finale.
Broadcasting from the top of the Eiffel Tower, the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
Now, see how much fun you can have with ventriloquism? So let's go on with our lesson. When talking for the dummy, speak in the front part of your mouth with the tip of your tongue in back of the upper front teeth. I find some students have a tendency to form their words back in the mouth. This gives a garbled effect like this. And so forth. Now, it should be up in front, of course, like this.
I had begun to wonder just...
Absolutely, but...
What is this noise?
Listening to the radio.
trying to listen to the radio. Dad, go downstairs.
Turn it off.
I'm gonna miss this whole thing.
Eat him.
In the grand ballroom at the top of the Eiffel Tower, the red velvet curtains part, and suddenly, the giant on-air sign above the stage lights up!
Broadcasting from the top of the Eiffel Tower, the orbiting human circus of the air. The orchestral starts us off with its version of Chopin's Here I Snore, May I for Hours More? Featuring guest vocalist Romika, the extraordinary singing song.
And so the saw's song rings out, filling the ballroom at the top of the Eiffel Tower and out into the night, reaching radios. Radios. Radios the world over. But there is one lonely soul who is not listening on the radio, nor is he watching from a seat in the broadcast ballroom. At the back of the stage, behind the singing saw, behind the shimmering backdrop, to the left of the props closet, tunneled into the brick wall beside the fuse box, a heating duct. And, curled deep inside this heating duct, claustrophobic and alone, hides Julian, janitor here at the Eiffel Tower, who secretly dreams of being on the radio.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. If I could just get a little bit higher. Oh, I can see.
Twice ejected from the broadcast ballroom already this week for disrupting the broadcast.
Oh, look out there. It's so beautiful.
He now prepares to sneak onto the stage once again. But that's just what he oughtn't do. You see, once inside, he can't seem to keep off the air.
Right next to the vent, there's a catwalk. I'm just going to go up on the catwalk, and I'll hide behind the curtain. I won't say a thing to anybody, I swear to God.
But that catwalk, it's rickety and old. It won't hold you.
They're dimming the lights. I'm going to go. Quiet. I'm going to open the vent.
But...
Forgive me, ladies and gentlemen, at home, it seems someone has fallen onto the stage from a great height, and is there a medic?
I'm all right.
It's Julian the janitor here at the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Are you all right?
Oh, I'm okay. Did you say something about the orchestral?
Well, I was just about to pull the blanket off its cage. Spotlight, please!
It's a bird.
Thank you very much, Julian. Moving right along. The orchestral is a rare African bird. They can play all 46 instruments in the orchestra at once.
But aren't there 47 instruments in an orchestra?
Orchestrals choose not to play the viola.
Wow.
Thank you, Julian.
Listen to that tiny piano.
Thank you, Julian.
What are you going to feed it?
Thank you. Thank you so much. And now a word from our sponsor.
We at Samuel Saws are proud to say...
On stage as the commercial rolls, chaos. The broadcast having suffered yet another janitorial interruption. And with the whole world listening, and it is...
The Circus of the Air is now the most listened to show on Earth.
Why? The whole world is listening to hear the extraordinary acts.
Miracles! Impossibilities!
They aren't listening to hear the janitor be tackled and bodily removed by host John Cameron. Which, luckily, they cannot hear due to the wisely timed sponsor announcement, which is about to end and return us to the live broadcast.
The leading instrument in all of today's popular music. Saws are flying off the shelves of hardware stores into the hearts of millions.
You are listening to the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
Please explain, Professor.
We've developed a machine that will allow us to hear the cricket song exactly as heard by the crickets themselves. I have a specimen here. I am now turning on the machine.
Well, here you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the cricket song, heard for the very first time by human ears exactly as heard by the cricket itself.
But as the little cricket sings its heart out on the air, there is one person who listens not on the radio, nor from a seat in the broadcast ballroom. In fact, he is not listening. Curled in a ball in the janitor's closet in which he lives, lies Julian, janitor of the Eiffel Tower, crying.
I'm not crying.
Mr. Cameron seemed very upset this time.
I know.
I think he was trying to strangle you.
I know. He only wanted to strangle me because he really loves the show. I love the show.
Then why do you interrupt it the way that you do?
All those old radio shows like Jack Benny, they all had these crazy characters who'd come crashing in and everybody would laugh and applaud.
Yes, but those things were planned. Those people were actors. They were...
I know. Funny.
Yes.
I could be funny, but then I just see that microphone.
Well, even professionals get stage fright. There's a million people listening.
But it's not that. It's the opposite of that. I love...
It's all right. Take your time.
What? When I was a kid, I always had to hide in the basement, and one time I was hiding behind these boxes, and I found this tape machine. It was my father's. My father was a show person. I never met him. He died. When I found that tape machine, I was just so... I started playing with it. You pretend that you're making a radio show, and... I pretended I was on the stage, and there was an audience, and there were people listening all over the world.
What exactly was your childhood like?
Cleaning. Well, I mean, I was the one who did all the cleaning in the house, and I was always supposed to be cleaning. Even when I made the radio shows, I was supposed to be cleaning, and my...
Wait. You were supposed to be cleaning... And instead you'd pretend you were putting on a radio show.
Yeah, I'd get in trouble. My stepfather was, one thing he used to do is he'd, like, lift me up by the hair.
So he'd barge in and interrupt your show.
Oh, you ruin it. The audience would go away, everything I was imagining would go away, and then it would just be my stepfather.
So what happened?
Well, this one time I was pretending to do my radio show, and I was pretending I had this act on the show, and there were these bells. They were the flying bells of Toulouse, and there were these bells that just floated in from the back of the theater, and they floated all around the audience's heads, you know, in the studio audience, and they floated up by the microphone and up by the stage where I was, well, I was imagining I was, and it was so beautiful. I didn't hear my stepfather come in, and my stepfather came in, and he hit me in the ear, and my ear started ringing, but the ringing, well, it started bleeding, but the ringing made the bells stay. Like, normally when he came in, everything went away, but this time the ringing made the bells stay, and when the bells stayed, the audience stayed, and the whole thing stayed, and suddenly I wasn't alone. I always had the audience. After that, no matter what I did, I'd just imagine there was an audience. I mean, I know it's not real.
No, it's not.
But that microphone on that stage with Mr. Cameron, that audience is real.
But that's just it. It is real. Sneaking onto that stage uninvited is no way to make people like you. Not the audience, not the sponsors, and certainly not Mr. Cameron. It's his whole life. And I'm afraid you've shortened it.
I'm gonna make it up to him. I'm gonna clean his dressing room. I'm gonna make it so nice that he'll have to forgive me.
You can't sneak back in there. If they fire you, where will you go? How will you eat?
I think I know a way we can get in over here.
But who is this personality who cannot resist the bright lights of the stage, the beautiful shining microphones, the hypnotic pull of laughter and applause? Who is this personality who has gone so far as to imagine a narrator to keep him company announcing the events of his life as if he were the star of screen, stage, or story?
God, you make me sound like such a freak. Everyone should have a narrator.
Thank you, but don't go in there.
Jean-Pierre, where are you?
Over here.
Yeah, we're right here.
Look, it's Letitia Sautier. She's cool. She's the chief stagehand. She runs the show. Look, she's not looking. Quick, before she comes.
So remember, place the German shepherds on the left side of the stage and the German shepherd on the right, or the sheep they get spooked.
I know, we got it.
Okay, and bend your legs when you leave the dog.
I know.
I know, but I tell you, and you don't do it. I won't have you injured.
Suddenly, host John Cameron comes rushing in.
Which side of the dog's on?
Left, left.
Right. Right. Did you get rid of the janitor? He ruined the entire opening.
Yeah, we got rid of the janitor. You're on. Allez, allez. I am afraid of this janitor. Such a small guy, but such a large destructive force. Why should it be so hard to keep him out? He's like he can pass through the wall. It's like we need to call the exterminator.
We're still
back to work!
And so, having snuck into the host's dressing room, really a very terrible idea, the janitor begins cleaning furiously.
I'm not furious.
It's a manner of speech. But as he cleans, he hears, coming distantly from the stage, the final musical number of the evening, which means only one thing. His favorite part of the show is about to begin. He listens and cleans quietly because each night ends with a story, a feature presentation, a bizarre artifact, real people telling real stories on tape. Well, you'll hear for yourself, because here comes Chief Stagehand Letitia Saltier rolling the large tape machine past.
Hello, attention, get out of the way. This machine, it is heavy. A person can be injured.
And on to the stage.
The Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
What you're about to hear, ladies and gentlemen, is absolutely real. There are some things in life for which words cannot prepare you. We therefore ask you to prepare yourselves for our feature presentation, Goldsby and Rue.
When I was 9 years old, my father died and we had to move. Mm-hmm. And my mother had to go to work. Mm-hmm. I was often alone, very often left alone in the house. And it was a complete change of locale, change of friends, change of teachers and everything. This was all during the war. Mm-hmm. And I even remember being in school in the playground, and I remember where a German Luftwaffe plane came over and he dive-bombed and machine-gunned. But we all laid down in the ground and the plane came very low and all the bullets were going. But he obviously was deliberately missing because nobody was hurt. It's funny because I'm sort of recalling now. It makes me, you know, I haven't thought about it for years and years and years, but I remember that time now. I remember it's all very vivid what happened from the first step. I noticed that my mother was being snubbed by the neighbours. And I learned it was because she was working for Goldsby and Rue, two barristers. I had no idea at the time what a barrister did. I had been told by other children that they had never lost a case. I realised they were very famous. They were famous for representing rich and powerful people. And on many occasions, freeing them, even though they were guilty. Mm-hmm. Got new identities for them and relocated them. Sometimes witnesses were relocated, but defendants being relocated was unheard of. The press called them Goldsby and Rue. Ghoul, like a monster. It was really Goldsby. People were talking about my mother. Mm-hmm. I asked her why she was working for these people whom everybody thought were really... She wouldn't say a bad word about Goldsby and Rue. Mm-hmm. I was upset that she wouldn't tell me why. And we always had blackouts, you know. It was dark everywhere. There were no electric lights on. All lights were out, had been blown out. And all you heard was the bombs going off all around. I began to feel lonely and sad. At this time, there was a famous trial going on about the Kensington child murders. It was announced that Goldsby and Rue was going to defend the child murderer. Goldsby and Rue were working my mother so hard, I saw less and less of her. It became apparent that they were going to win the case on a series of technicalities. The public was outraged because a child murderer was going to be set free. Everybody knew that he would be hidden and he would be given a new identity. After the verdict was announced, I overheard that Goldsby and Rue were going to have a celebratory dinner. And so I made a decision. That evening, I followed my mother to Goldsby and Rue's chambers. She went for her keys. She couldn't get in because I had already taken her keys. So she knocked. After my mother went in, I went up and tried the key and tried to get in after her. And after the door closed behind me, I suddenly realized I was in the house with a murderer. God, I was scared of being discovered by either my mother or the murderer. I can tell you, it really was quite scary. So I hid in the pantry. I stayed in there quite a while, wondering what to do. At the end of the pantry, there was a light coming under the door. So I went up to the door and peeped through the keyhole. And I could see how and where they were going to hide the child murderer. In fact, they were already doing it. There's some pretty awful things that people see. They don't want to, but, you know, it just happens and you see it. They were eating him. And I realized this must be what happened to all their clients. Wasn't much fun. My mother was some other place in the building. I got away as fast as I could. My mother knew. My mother never knew that I had been there. Mm-hmm. We became much closer. There was no longer a gulf between us. It had dissolved, disappeared. I never repeated the story.
Broadcasting from the top of the Eiffel Tower, the orbiting human circus of the air.
Hiding behind the curtain, the janitor peers out at the show he loves.
Well, that's all for this week, ladies and gentlemen. This is John Cameron, broadcasting from the top of the Eiffel Tower. The orbiting human circus wishes you a good night.
The Orbiting Human Circus of the Air is a co-presentation of WNYC Studios and Night Vale Presents. Welcome to this special commentary for Season 1 of The Orbiting Human Circus. If you are a new listener, we strongly recommend that you listen to the complete narrative season first, and then return to these commentaries. We begin with John Cameron Mitchell, who plays John Cameron, and the show's writer and creator, Julian Coster, who plays the janitor, discussing the history of the friendship that led up to their working together on the Orbiting Human Circus.
So my first memory of recording with you, we actually recorded on your couch in your living room. I remember, like, we were, like, I'd come over. I should also, so John, you lived in that apartment for how many years?
25.
25 years. Wow. So
rent stabilized.
And he, so that apartment is like a really special place for me, because I've had many, many memories. John and I, we've been friends for a long time.
Where did we meet?
I think we met in
94.
It was the early mid 90s.
Mm-hmm. Right when I was starting Hedvig.
Yeah, you were starting Hedvig, and actually, there's some good actually memories from back then.
I was making Hedvig. Was Music Tapes together?
Music Tapes was beginning.
It
was the very beginning of the Music Tapes, and you were on the first Music Tapes single.
Was that?
Yeah, you did. You were the smoke.
As the fireman needs me, I'll climb up the chimney and leap from roof to roof. He did this amazing, you know, kind of voice, this narration, this kind of,
So you're starting to think about old-timey radio-y things. You were recording on wire recorders and not wax cylinders, but...
No, we were then, actually.
You were?
Yeah, no, that was the record that we were doing wax cylinder stuff.
Right, so your interest in that was very early.
Yeah. I know it was very strong then already.
And you played saw for me in a couple shows early on for Hedvig.
Yeah, I was the Angry Inches saw player.
At the Public Theater, which was a disastrous reading.
Not because of the saw playing, though, right?
No. I never heard back from them, yay or nay. But they regretted it.
Yeah, the audience liked it.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Yeah.
And also our cat. So,
your cat peed on my cape.
Yes, Hedvig's cape, which is really a very specific cape because it's painted and it has
painted,
all this very specific stuff on
like
it.
I think Berlin it wall.
Yeah,
it was for our first production at Westbeth, I think in '97, and I stored it in your apartment in the Village, which was, had aluminum foil all over it, like Andy Warhol's factory, and it was like a workshop. And I should have thought better than to give you my cape, because what happened to it?
This apartment we all lived in, this was in the West Village. It was rent stabilized, which meant that it was $425 a month.
That sounded like rent controlled.
Well, no, but back in those days, I guess it had been stabilized since the 70s. It's now we're getting into stuff that only people in New York City even know what we're talking about.
It's called socialism, people. There's a vestige of it left. That's why New York is not all rich people.
No, but the apartment is like as big as like a walk-in closet, basically.
Yeah.
And there was tinfoil walls and ceiling and painted otherwise. But there was several people living in it and a dog and a cat. And there was no kitchen. It was this tiny room. And so, yeah, I don't know why you wanted to store it at our place, because...
Well, I didn't have anywhere else to put it.
I know, but our apartment's smaller than yours.
I know, but I had pretensions of closets and things like that.
So anyway, so the Hedvig's cape, which was like, you know, again, it's like it was an irreplaceable prop, was basically peed on by our terrified cat.
And dog.
Well, and I don't know if they both feed on it
together.
They might have their first.
But finest. You didn't even notice till I asked for it. Oh God, Julian, tell the story of Hedvig's first film appearance, which was part of your concert tour, probably 94, 95.
So okay, so this was the first. I guess this was Hedvig's film debut. This was her first starring role, and it was for a film that I was making for our tour, to be a part of our tour, and we went...
The Music Tapes.
Yeah. And we went to...
Central Park Conservancy.
Well, we went to there was this really ornate, up by Harlem in Central Park, up at the north part of Central Park, there's this really ornate restroom.
in the conservancy, which is a part of the park that's very fancy and beautiful, kind of French garden. And it has the best bathroom in Central Park.
It does.
Very ornate. And the idea was that your character was coming to ask Hedwig about, you know, like going to an oracle to find out some information to go somewhere else. So you had me with an oriental rug and a lamp and an overstuffed chair, and we brought it all into the men's room, which was beautiful. But I was like, I don't have time to do my makeup. So we did the makeup outside my sunglasses, but not under them. And I'm like, and he left me alone in there, on the chair, in drag, with a lamp and a rug to get the camera. And then two park police walked in. We stared at each other for a long time because they were trying to figure out what the charge was, what the law was that was being broken, and they couldn't. And then one of them said, "You can't have that chair in here." And I was like, "All right." I knew it was going to be something. It wasn't that I was the wrong gender or there was a rug or electrical lamp lit up. It was the chair. And then I had to leave, and then you reshot it on a pile of boulders.
Yeah, we found a pile of boulders, and then we decided to set it in what was it, Latvia?
Bosnia.
In Bosnia.
During the war.
We just were thinking on the fly.
And there were geese.
And then there were geese there, and John, as Hedwig, went to feed the geese, and we got this beautiful footage of John, of Hedwig trying to feed the geese and the geese fleeing from him.
Running
away from him.
I got Cheetos and they're very bright in the rubble. And then you lost the footage.
And then, years later, the footage. You wanted it late by the time that Hedwig went around.
Did you find it?
Oh, no. But I mean, it was lost. It wasn't lost. It was in the tour.
No.
It was in the film.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
It was. And then, but the problem was I was a complete nomad in those days. I didn't have a home. And like I was, at that point, I was just like sleeping on people's couches and my possessions all kind of.
Yeah, but you saved your masters of your music, haven't you?
No, the record companies did that.
Oh, okay.
Those records wouldn't exist either. So a lot of the material that we recorded together, you and I, you did come into the various places that we recorded, but we also did a bunch at your apartment. And that place, you know, it's just like, I feel like it's been like one of my home bases, you know, because even my family, yeah, you know, it's just like you've been there for so long and it's always been a place you can stay. John, you know, when John goes away, he's wonderful about letting you stay. And even when I didn't live in New York, I'd come stay and then just coming to see John. So it was a really cozy place to record. And so
it's got wall-to-wall carpeting, which is rare.
Right. And it's really good for recording. So like, so in a lot of the scenes that we did together, like in this episode, were definitely recorded there, some of them.
Just your little Zoom recorder?
Yeah.
This is portable.
I have this older Zoom recorder that has a really wonderful sound that I use for a lot of stuff. I mean, we use a bunch of different mics in the show, and some stuff is studio, but then I do a lot of stuff in different places with that. And so I remember we did the first thing we ever did was the on-air sequence in this episode, where you're trying to introduce the orchestral, and I kind of come bounding in and interrupt. And I remember that part of the reason that my name is Julian on the show and your name is John is because I hadn't really, that was kind of before the characters really existed fully in the story. We were just playing with things.
Yeah.
And so I was just calling you John and you were calling me Julian. But then the recording was wonderful and that was kind of like formed the basis of it. So that's actually how you became John Cameron, the character, you know, and I became Julian the janitor.
I mean, I remember you just sort of kept trying to get me to be more old-fashioned, you know?
Yeah, well, John Cameron, I feel like, is sort of like the showman in you, kind of personified, come to life, you know? And I mean, you're nothing like him, but at the same time, you know, it's like you definitely share a soul. But I feel like that quality in you, as he came to life, you know, I see him so clearly. He's so different from you, but he's...
Does he have facial hair?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Because I can't grow anything.
Yeah, that's probably why. But you're so funny.
as the hat?
Is John Cameron. Well, I mean, I think he wears many different, you know, many different outfits, but he's a man of great dignity. John Cameron's a man of great dignity, and that dignity is always being challenged.
Yes.
Horribly.
As mine is daily.
That was John Cameron Mitchell and Julian Coster, and we'll return to their conversation in the coming episodes. The Orbiting Human Circus is written, created, and co-directed by Julian Coster. It was co-directed by and developed with Ellie Heyman and produced by Christy Gressman, with musical composition and arrangement by Thomas Hughes and songs by The Music Tapes, and editing by Grant Stewart, sound design by Eric Slider, with recording engineer Vincent Cascione and associate producer Robbie Cucciaro. Episode 1 featured Julian Coster, Drew Callender, John Cameron Mitchell, Susanna Flood, Dan Solomon, John Zrzeski, Brian DeWan, Jesse Shelton, Chaim Wolf, Cecil Baldwin, and Joan Hirsch. For full credits and to learn more about the Orbiting Human Circus, come visit us at orbitinghumancircus.com and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.